Hey, this is Simon Scriver.
And this is Nikki Bell.
We are running a virtual fundraising conference on November 19th. It's called Fundraising Everywhere, and you can find it at fundraisingeverywhere.com.
There's some amazing speakers that we've got lined up for you. We've got some names on there that you will be familiar with and some speakers that you may not have heard before, but all of them will be sharing amazing fundraising methods that are proven to work, and they will be teaching us how to do that in our own charities.
We've tried to make it really affordable for all organizations, but for small charities, it is completely free. So go look at it at fundraisingeverywhere.com, register now. Join us. It will be accessible, it will be affordable, and it is amazing.
Yes.
You're listening to Simon Scriver's Amazingly Ultimate Fundraising Superstar podcast, talking all things fundraising, charities, nonprofits, and more. Here's your host, as always, Simon Scriver.
I'm sure, like me, you've read or seen plenty of articles about behavioral economics, or you've seen things about behavioral economics mentioned online. And you, like me, maybe pretend to understand what it means, or, you know, try and take some of the bits of facts to pass on. But at the end of the day, do we really know anything about it? And the truth is, I certainly don't. So I've invited my guest on today to talk about it, because she is an expert in behavioral economics, supposedly. And her name is Dana Siegel. Dana, hello.
Hello, Simon. How are you?
Yeah, I'm okay. How are you today?
I'm really good. I'm chuffed to be on your podcast, which I listen to on a weekly basis.
That's very kind of you.
Awesome.
Nice. Well, I'm chuffed that you finally made it on, because you're a hard woman to get. Yeah. So you, am I right in saying you're an expert in behavioral economics? Is that kind of a bit too much?
Or? I think where I'm really interested in it as a theory is how it can be applied specifically to not just fundraising as a kind of form or skill, but also just generally for a bit more good. Mm-hmm. So I, in terms of my kind of fundraising career, I'm a bit of a jack of all trades, in the sense that I've done a lot of individual giving, I've done stuff with businesses, I've done events, I've done community fundraising, I've done legacies. And I guess where my consultancy and my training comes into practice is, what are the interesting techniques or things that we can learn from outside the sector that could apply to any of those fields? And when I started working with Bernard Ross at the Management Centre, and he was developing a lot of his theories about how behavioural economics can come into the sector, I was like, wow, this is so interesting, and it's kind of blowing my mind a little bit. And it's one of those things that once you see, you kind of cannot unsee. So yeah, I mean, I would say that I'm developing into an expert, perhaps. But I would say at this point, a curious enthusiast.
Okay, well, that's good enough for me. So for people who don't know you, you mentioned Bernard there. So that's Bernard Ross, who I have a lot of time for.
Yes.
So you do some work, you work for Bernard at
the Management Centre, that's right. So I'm a senior partner consultant there. So I work with Bernard and the wider Management Centre team to offer management consultancy, fundraising consultancy, and training for charities, NGOs, INGOs, and we work worldwide, internationally. I'm also the deputy director of the National Arts Fundraising School, which is a twice a year course that we run for arts, cultural and heritage organisations in the UK to teach them how to raise funds. Mm-hmm. And then I also work as a fundraiser in a capacity with some colleagues at an organisation called Adapt for Arts.
So, wow.
Yeah, kind of do consultancy, training, coaching and fundraising all together.
You have like three jobs.
I do have three jobs, which is why I'm a hard woman to get hold of.
Yeah, okay. So I've seen Bernard speak a lot of times, and he talks a lot about behavioural economics. He generally talks about how to use it to save money, or to get people he knows to spend more money on him. But if we can widen the net a bit, can you tell me what is it? Again, this is my trick on the podcast. Assume I'm an idiot.
Okay.
Which I am.
Assuming, yeah.
What is behavioral economics? And especially when it comes to fundraising, marketing, the business we're in. What is it?
So the theory is rooted in an amazing practitioner, an amazing thinker called Daniel Kahneman. And Daniel Kahneman has very interesting theories about the brain. His book, Thinking Fast and Slow, which you might have heard of, mm-hmm. or some of the listeners might have heard of, covers the kind of initial theories that he has around this. Everything was founded based on the fact that he was thinking that economics as a model, as in the way that supply demand, the way that we operate in this world, is based on a very logical system. Mm-hmm. But the truth is that people are not very logical. We're actually extremely irrational in our decision-making process. So why is this whole way that we work predicated on the fact that we're supposed to be logical when the truth is that we're quite irrational? So he's done a lot of theorizing about this. And in essence, thinking about the brain as kind of two systems. So you have system one, which is your fast, impulsive, intuitive self. So this is very much an emotional and irrational space that we operate in, and the truth is that we mostly operate in that space about 80 to 90% of our time. Mm-hmm. System two is our logical, rational, analytical selves. When we really sit there and get a bit of brain hurt, it's likely that we've been using our system two system. And a good analogy between the two is that when you first learn how to drive, you're operating in system two. You're having to think a lot about everything that you're doing, the way you're using the gear stick, the way you're using your feet, the observations that you're making. But over time, people get to a point with driving where they do it so intuitively that they forget they're even doing it, and their mind's thinking about loads of other stuff. That point, they're in system one. That person has driven themselves to work or to wherever they need to go without even actually really thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And he has this lovely saying. He says system two is how we think, but system one is actually how we think most of the time. So his theory is that most of the time we're operating in an irrational and an emotional space. And if we are in the business of changing people's behaviors, we need to be matching and mirroring that system, not the super logical and rational system.
So, because we all would like to think we're logical and we're making logical decisions. Precisely. But we hear it in fundraising a lot, like people make donations emotionally. I know Bernard has kind of pulled up on that phrase. I've heard him pull people up on that phrase before. But it is that system one. That's where a lot of our donor decisions come
Absolutely.
From.
Absolutely. And we're not necessarily doing enough to satisfy that or to meet that. So, you know, I mean, a lot of the time us fundraisers, we're suckers for statistics, facts, impact figures, things like that. And we sort of, sometimes we're convinced that that's the things that they want to hear. Mm-hmm. But actually what that tends to do is pull someone away from their kind of emotional space into a more rational, logical space. Mm-hmm. So even just small things like that can have a real effect. And what happens is that, so if that's the theory behind behavioral economics, it means that we need to understand the way that our brain works and the shortcuts that it makes in order to make quick and irrational decisions. Mm-hmm. So they're called heuristics. That's the name for them. But basically think of them as like neural shortcuts in your mind.
You can't see this, but Dan is looking at me like I'm a child. Rightly so, because I don't understand this word, heuristic.
It's basically, as I was saying, think about it as, the kind of mental shortcuts that you might make to arrive at a decision quicker.
And is this, because when you first started talking about it, I was thinking this is like, monkeyish drilled into us since the birth of man. Like this is, but then you're talking about driving, which is something which is quite a new, something that can be taught quite quickly, and then it becomes ingrained in your brain. So how is this developing? Is this in us from birth, or is it?
Yeah, I mean, so much of it is also connected to evolutionary psychology. So look at you, no dummies at all. So much of it is connected to evolutionary psychology, and the more that we're learning about the way that we behaved not that long ago, when actually the world has developed so rapidly, whereas actually our minds and the way that we think and the way that we process and make decisions hasn't. We tend to fall back on our kind of basic evolutionary psychology a lot. So an example of that, an example heuristic, an example mental shortcut is social proof. Mm-hmm. So when somebody else or a group of people approve something, we tend to go with the crowd. Mm-hmm. The reason that we do that is because back in the day, we didn't want to be isolated from our, tribes.
Yeah.
So there are amazing experiments that you can find out about online where they have primed a room of people to deliberately say the wrong answer just to test whether someone will go along with the wrong answer or not. Even though they obviously know and logically know that it's the wrong answer. And so many more times than not, people just agree with the room rather than trust their own instinct about what is the right answer. And the reason for that is because the power of going against the crowd and against the community is so much stronger than just being right or being logical.
Because a few thousand years ago, they would have been bludgeoned with a bone.
Absolutely.
So it's a survival.
Or other apparatus, I'm not sure. But yeah, something along those lines. So it's partly a survival instinct, which is... And what I find interesting about that is that you talk to a lot of fundraisers and they understand the power of peer pressure, they understand the power of kind of social norming, mm-hmm. but they wouldn't necessarily identify that as a heuristic or connected to behavioural science or decision science. Mm-hmm. So it's those crossovers that I find really fascinating when they match with theories that we've made about fundraising, but also times where they completely clash or go against what we think is right in fundraising as well.
I'm curious about that stuff that we think is right.
Yeah.
Any examples that come to mind?
Yeah. So another heuristic that I often think about when it comes to fundraising is one that's called the paradox of choice. Uh-huh. So when we're presented with more options, although we think we want more options, the truth is we're less likely to make a decision. So actually, when we're presented with fewer options, we make better decisions. So. Uh-huh. You know, I'm thinking, for example, if you're on a website and you give someone five different donation options or different levels, mm-hmm. that's actually more debilitating than if you just told them one or two. Mm-hmm. But actually, a lot of fundraisers say, oh, no, but you need to show choice. You need to show range of donations. You need to have lots of choices.
We need to give the donor whatever they want. We need to be completely
flexible. Yeah, but the truth is, when you look at the way that they've behaved, that's not actually gone in their favour. So that's one where, actually, if you question it and you look at decision science or behavioral economics rather than, I guess, quote unquote, traditional fundraising theory, mm-hmm. that's where that clash is.
So is that coming from, I mean, I keep thinking of this phrase we talk about in fundraising, whereas you're not your target audience. And so we're like, as fundraisers, you know, we do have the time to sit behind our computer for 40 hours, 50 hours a week, think about this. Mm. Do we kind of cross into that logical brain where we've got to the point where we're trying to be rational about it, but we're forgetting that the donor is someone who's making this decision quite fleetly? They're not like us. Like, they're real people.
Yeah, exactly. As opposed to us kind of,
us weird fundraising
data-y, nerdy fundraising people. It's an interesting one because there are implications within this to your working environment in the sense that, like, there may be elements of biases or heuristics that are playing out that even affect the way that you work and make decisions at work. So I don't know, it's one of those things that's like the matrix. Like, once you start to kind of peel back the layers of understanding about all these different heuristics and biases that we live with, you kind of can't unsee it after that, and everything could be the result of or the catalyst of a particular behavior. So it's a strange space, but I would say generally, I mean, that kind of, it's one of Bernard Ross's famous phrases, isn't it? I'm not the target market. That reminder that no, we are not our donors. But I guess I would say that if you are in a fundraising position now, and especially if you're interacting in a space where you're dealing with a lot of individuals, you don't have to be an expert in this stuff, but it's really important to just school up a little bit on it so that you understand that this is another psychological system at play in amongst all the ones that you might already know or understand a little bit more, because there's more writing about it specific to fundraising.
Yeah.
There's lots of stuff we can read about relationship fundraising and all of that. But this is a new school of science and a new school of psychology, and we have to be as aware of this as we are about the other ones if we're going to make really good decisions or change people's behaviours when it comes to giving.
It's not necessarily fundraising specific, but it's just if we can understand how the brains of our supporters work.
Absolutely. And then I think it can be really fundraising specific and really interesting in the sense that even some of the ones that we talked about now, there's so many different heuristics. There's actually over 200 heuristics, 200 different biases that all of us do.
Can you name them all?
Could you imagine? There's this beautiful chart online, which is like this gigantic circle of biases, and it's just lovely. Now, I can't name them all, but I can definitely name a few that I think are the most interesting or relevant. I've definitely got favourites.
Yeah.
I'm also thinking about the ones that are the most like random or funny.
Yeah.
So.
Like, give me an example, because I'm struggling with this seriously.
One of my favourites is the rhyme is reason effect. Okay. So, basically, if a sentence rhymes, we're more likely to believe that it's true.
Okay.
That's just a weird thing that we all do for some reason, even though it doesn't make sense.
Like, an apple a day keeps the doctor away.
Precisely, exactly that. A really famous one is from the O.J. Simpson trial.
Yeah.
If it doesn't fit, then you must acquit. And they made the decision to not... Yeah. So he was, you know what
you think he was guilty?
Let's not get into this. Okay. But yeah. So Rhymer's Reason is a really interesting one. I was trying to think of what like a fundraising one would be for that.
Yeah. I mean, we don't really use rhyme in fundraising because it seems naff.
It doesn't. But actually, but I wonder, like, wouldn't that be an amazing and interesting experiment?
Yeah, I bet there is one.
I was trying to think about if somebody was working for a wildlife conservation charity or maybe a charity that's looking after bees. And I was like, if you want the honey, give us some money. Or so, I don't know, I was just like, I'll have an example one. But no, I didn't come up with a good one in time for our podcast. Yeah,
there must be some out there. I'll find it.
Exactly.
And so, I mean, God, this seems like a lot of work for fundraisers who already have so much to learn and look into and research.
Mm.
Is there like a cheat sheet on it, or where do we start great learning question. About this stuff?
So there's obviously some really, really great reads. So for me, read number one is Change for Good, which is Bernard Ross's book, which he's written with Omar Mahmoud, who is the chief of global knowledge or global insight at UNICEF.
Wow.
They've written a brilliant book, which I know, amazing job title.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
They've written a brilliant book about how you can apply a lot of this stuff to the charitable sector or to social change and social justice.
Is this his book where all the profits go to charity, or is that a different book?
They go to Médecins Sans Frontières, so yeah.
Because every time I see Bernie, he's like, hey, buy my book, we profits good. You know, it's not a good Bernie impression, but...
Yes, that all the profits from that book
which
go
is pretty
to
cool.
MSF,
so
which
I must
is
get
fantastic.
That.
So that's a great place to start. We are currently, so the National Arts Fundraising School is conducting the largest ever experiment in arts and cultural fundraising, where we're taking 11 massive national organisations and getting them to do some decision science experiments in their places. So
that's cool. We've
got places like the Royal Opera House, Northern Ballet, lots of really fantastic organisations. And they're just in the process now. They've had their initial training from us, and they are coming up with their proposed ideas of how they can explore heuristics in their different fundraising functions across legacy giving, across fundraising in venues, across individual giving. So it's going to be really exciting, and I'm kind of really looking forward to seeing what comes of that.
Yeah.
So that will be great. So there's a website for that, decisionscience.org.uk, and we'll be posting all of our findings, I think, sort of towards spring 2020.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Those are quite UK focused.
Yes.
Are people in different parts of the world the same when it comes to this?
Ah, this is such a good question.
Thanks.
A good question.
Thanks. That's why I have a podcast.
So there are some that are and some that aren't. That's such a kind of like middle of the road answer. But generally, again, because so much of it is driven by evolutionary psychology, so much of it applies in different cultures, different settings.
Yes.
Yeah. It's fascinating. That for me is definitely the next part of it, is to see how can we apply this in fundraising settings in other markets that are very, very different to maybe the UK and the US markets, which are obviously the largest in the world, and you therefore have a large kind of donor base or data set to play with that kind of thing.
But
what we're seeing is that some of the larger INGOs like Médecins Sans Frontières and like UNICEF are adopting some of these techniques and kind of exploring them within their fundraising.
Okay.
So I don't think they would be doing that if they didn't think that would have an international impact.
Yeah, very true.
Yeah.
So the majority of charities who would listen to this, and the majority of fundraisers work for small charities.
Yes.
So obviously you can't like play around with data. You can't, you can't necessarily
very
do
true.
Split testing and stuff like that. So are there any kind of like, beginner tricks we can try? Anything that like, someone who's listening to this and then coming off the back of it, anything that they want to try? The thing I think of is, because I think the first time I really got exposed to this in fundraising was through Professor Jen Chang's stuff. She does a bit on this kind of behavioral stuff, and she was talking about or did some research on talking about what other donors give.
Yes.
So when you're speaking to a donor on the phone and actually saying, we had another donor who donated $100, how much would you like to donate? And how that influenced. And I thought that was amazing.
Yeah.
And to me, that seemed like something that you could bring in, even if you were only calling one donor, you could use that sort of social proofing.
Absolutely.
And the others. So if I'm just in a nonprofit tomorrow, any other things that jump out at you that you think? I don't mean to put you on the spot.
No, that's fine. I was just thinking about that, actually. So there's a couple of other heuristics that I think are super relevant to fundraising, mm-hmm. and I've been thinking a lot about, and I'll be talking in a bit more detail about at the Fundraising Everywhere conference.
Oh, wow. Actually, I keep forgetting to do a little commercial in a minute, so we'll just take a break to say that Dana is going to be speaking at Fundraising Everywhere. Go get your tickets at fundraisingeverywhere.com. It's free for small charities and very affordable for larger charities. But Dana is delivering our opening plenary about this kind of stuff. Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt you.
It's all good. So I think the format for that is going to be that I'll take a couple of the heuristics that I think are the most relevant to fundraising and then give some examples of how people could think about applying that back in their practice.
Amazing.
One of which that comes to mind is the heuristic about anchoring. Now, anchoring is a process whereby you provide a piece of information before that dictates the way that you react to a second piece of information.
Okay.
So an example of this, there's an amazing theorist called Robert Cialdini, who is, again, another amazing person to read if you haven't accessed his books before. He did an experiment for an organization that was seeking mental health volunteers, so people who would take somebody who was suffering with mental health challenges to a zoo for a day. And they did an experiment where they were surveying people on the street, and the options that they gave, the first suite of options, they said, okay, would you take someone who needed support out for a day trip to a zoo?
Mm-hmm.
And most people said no. They said, what? Okay. I know, right? Then they said, okay, well, if you wouldn't do that, do you think you would train for 2 years to get a mental health first aid qualification and be a fully certified mental health support worker? And everyone went, well, no.
Yeah.
What happens when you flip that? So you asked first and you said, would you like to study for 2 years to become a qualified support worker? People said no. They said, okay, well, if you won't do that, do you think you could take someone out for a day to the zoo?
Yeah.
And actually more people said, yeah, okay. And the reason that they did that is because suddenly the frame around it, the anchor was something much more difficult, something much more unachievable. But then when they were presented with a second kind of lighter, better, more realistic offer, they just went, okay, fine. Huh. So it affected the way that they made the decisions, even though they're the two same questions asked in exactly the same way to kind of same samples and types of people.
Yeah.
That's interesting in a fundraising context. And I remember when I presented that as an example at the Change for Good seminar that we did last year, the head of fundraising for MSF UK came up to me after the talk and he said, that really helped me understand why we had such a successful DM campaign. What we did is we wrote out to doctors and we said, would you consider being a doctor in the field? If not, would you consider donating to a doctor in the field?
Yeah.
And what happened is they anchored to those people. You know, the idea of leaving your family, your loved ones, going out there, you know, doing that thing.
Yeah.
And most people going, gosh, that must be so difficult, so hard, I would never do that. And then suddenly they thought about the value of a potential donation in a different way.
Huh.
So they didn't know that they did that in that way. They didn't realize that that was the heuristic that sat behind that. But that's a really interesting example for me of how you could use an anchoring technique in a direct mail that you were doing.
Yeah, or in a conversation or anything you give.
Absolutely.
That's interesting.
So Simon, I've just been sitting here and I've been thinking, do you mind lending me £1,000?
No, I don't really have it, but
have you got a quid so I can get a cup of tea?
I actually don't even have that. I only have euro.
Didn't quite work.
But yeah, no, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Are people just like idiots, or is it like, are we really easy to manipulate and really easy to,
ooh,
like, we seem to make a lot of stupid decisions?
Well, it's interesting when you think about how behavioral economics and decision science has made such an impact in the commercial world, as in, you know, everything that drives the way that Uber, Spotify, I mean Amazon create the way and the functionality behind their platforms and their softwares, so much of it is driven by decision science. So it does feel a bit odd when you suddenly think, wow, there are small tweaks and changes and things that can happen that can suddenly affect or change the behaviours of loads of people. When that's done to a negative effect, i.e. just to make Jeff Bezos some more money, you kind of go, oh, that feels a bit wrong, which is why I think we're so keen to just see the people who are doing good use it. Are we idiots? Not really. We're just driven by our heart more than we give ourselves credit for. And also, we're just a bit lazy. We don't want to think too much. That's our issue. So any process that eases that thought for us, we take advantage of, because it's a relief for our brains. So it's not that we're idiots. It's just that we're naturally lazy and we don't want to use up too much of our energy. Again, that's connected back to an evolutionary psychology time where we only have the energy that we have and we need to survive out in the wilderness. So we had to kind of conserve our energy.
Before the dinosaurs come.
Exactly.
Something
before
like
the yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll see.
Okay, this is really interesting, and there's obviously a lot we could go into, but I'm going to leave it there because firstly, I don't want any spoilers for Fundraising Everywhere, because you're going to be doing the opening. But obviously, there's a lot more to talk about on this another time, perhaps.
Absolutely.
So if people want to follow you and understand this stuff that we're talking about, where is the best place for them to find you?
Well, best place. So I would definitely say check out the decisionscience.org.uk website. My Twitter handle is Dana K. Siegel. And I can be found generally on Management Centre websites and the National Arts Fundraising School website.
You do a bit of blogging, don't you? You do a bit of
speaking. I do a bit of
blogging,
bit of speaking. Speaking? Not today, apparently. Yeah. Yeah, I do a bit of speaking. I'm trying to think, apart from Fundraising Everywhere, I'm not sure I've got any big conferences coming up. And I'm doing a fair bit of work kind of internationally and stuff, so I'll be around. But I am always online.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I do a lot of blogging from the National Arts Fundraising School side. Okay. And no doubt there'll be lots of stuff that we're producing off the back of this amazing experiment that we're doing as well.
But people should definitely reach out to you if they want to use this mumbo jumbo to manipulate
really
people.
What a beautiful summary. If you're interested to know the latest thinking about why people behave the way they do,
reach out. Yeah.
And I'm sure there's things that we can kind of help you figure out and decide, and lots of case studies and lots of examples, really building the suite of stuff to draw on. And it comes back to social proof and social norming, as in the more charities and NGOs and INGOs we support to do this work, the more will come on board to realise that they need to do it as well. So, yeah.
That's cool. All right. Well, thank you very much for coming on. Let's speak again after Fundraising Everywhere, and we can cover stuff that you haven't, that you don't cover at that.
Awesome.
But thanks for making time for me.
Thank you. So good to see you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Simon Scriver's Amazingly Ultimate Fundraising Superstar Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and head over to changefundraising.com to learn more or get in touch with Simon. Or don't. Whatever. You're big enough to make your own decisions.
Hey, this is Simon Scriver.
And this is Nikki Bell.
We are running a virtual fundraising conference on November 19th. It's called Fundraising Everywhere, and you can find it at fundraisingeverywhere.com.
There's some amazing speakers that we've got lined up for you. We've got some names on there that you will be familiar with and some speakers that you may not have heard before, but all of them will be sharing amazing fundraising methods that are proven to work, and they will be teaching us how to do that in our own charities.
We've tried to make it really affordable for all organizations, but for small charities, it is completely free. So go look at it at fundraisingeverywhere.com. Register now. Join us. It will be accessible. It will be affordable, and it is amazing.
Yes.